The first Israeli hostages captured by Hamas are returned.
They were taken by the Red Cross to Rafah, the crossing point with Egypt, and then from Egypt they were taken by helicopter to an Israeli Air Force base.
How did Qatar emerge as a key broker in the ceasefire deal?
Israel understood that, you know, if you have the Qataris with such influence over Hamas, that may be helpful sometime down the road.
What recommendations can be made from research into Arabic language anti-American propaganda?
The first thing the United States needs to do is to get a serious counter-propaganda policy in place that's a unified policy that's across the DoD.
And China is pressing ahead with ambitious nuclear energy expansion plans. Today is Friday, November 24th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Miller. The Israeli military released videos it said showed strikes on Hamas targets before the start of a four-day ceasefire in the Gaza Strip Friday morning. The footage came as Israeli military tanks and armored vehicles were seen leaving northern Gaza. Many of the soldiers from the vehicles that were leaving were seen smiling, some even holding up the Israeli flag, while others showed the peace sign, a thumbs up, and raising their fists. A temporary ceasefire between Israeli forces and Hamas kicked off in the Gaza Strip on Friday morning. It's the first respite in 48 days of conflict that has devastated the Palestinian enclave, though both sides warned that the war is far from over. Israeli Foreign Minister Eli Cohen.
We will continue after the pause for the safety of Israel, and we call to the entire world to work with us to free Gaza from Hamas.
No big bombs, artillery strikes, or rocket attacks were reported, although Hamas and Israel both accused one another of sporadic shootings and other violations. Well, after a temporary ceasefire between Israel and Hamas began, and several hours before some Israeli hostages were set to be released from Gaza, people in Tel Aviv expressed a variety of emotions about the deal, like Avnion Fisher.
The strike today because I wanted to hug the families that are not getting their dears one. I think it's terrible for all of us. I think we didn't win this war. I don't like when they say win because we didn't win, we already lost. But what we do have is our people, our dear country that we love. And I think what we need, and this will be a really war, a really triumph, if we can get them back. This is, I think, what we all do. This is what I think all, what the government should do, what the army to bring them home. This is the main thing. We don't know what situation they are. We can only imagine. So it's a lot of stressful days. Then we hope they are coming back as much as they can.
And Reza Yaakov Cohen also shared the bittersweetness of the moment.
It's very emotional for me because it was so brutal. I think all of us, all the Israeli people live in trauma now. So we're still in a trauma. So I think it will be very emotional to see them back now. I think we'll be very, very happy and very emotional when tear and with a hug. And in the other side, we'll be very concerned because we know that most of the hostages are still there. They will not come back in this during this ceasefire. So it's not a real relief. We're not very happy now.
And nearly an hour after the scheduled release of the Israeli hostages was to take place, the first reports began emerging of that confirmation via Israeli media. Joining me from Jerusalem is Linda Gradstein. So, Linda, we've just got word that some of the hostages have been released. Can you kind of walk us through what we expect to happen for the rest of this day, for this first batch of prisoners?
So the 13 hostages, women and children, most of them are from a kibbutz called Nir Oz, from which 70 people were kidnapped among the total of 240 hostages. And they were taken by the Red Cross to Rafah, the crossing point with Egypt. And then from Egypt, they were taken by helicopter to an Israeli Air Force base where they first called their families. They had brief medical checks and then were taken to more isolated hospitals all over Israel. Israel had lots of psychologists and trauma counselors waiting. The children, by the way, you know, there's a lot of fear of what kind of condition they're going to be in. Many of them probably don't know what happened on October 7th, the Hamas massacre of 1,200 people. So the Israeli government has asked the public to stay away from the hospitals, to give people their privacy. But the entire country has been sort of on edge, just waiting for this release to happen. And Hamas has agreed over the four-day ceasefire to release 50 hostages. Of those, we're talking mostly women and children. Separately, Egypt said that it had negotiated the release of 12 Thai hostages, and it's not clear exactly, you know, when that's going to happen. And Israel has agreed to release 3 Palestinian prisoners for every hostage who's released. So they will be released in the West Bank from the Ofer prison, and those are both women and minors.
Yeah, and I'm seeing tweets from or ex posts from Thai officials saying that they have confirmed that their personnel are a part of the deal. You mentioned the prisoner swap. What is known about the process for the release of the prisoners that Israel has that are going to be released?
Israel has agreed to release a total of 150 prisoners. It came up with a list of 300, many of whom had been held under what's called administrative detention. They hadn't been tried and convicted, although there are some who have been convicted of terrorist attacks. None of them have been convicted of murder. And the Palestinians from the West Bank will be taken to a checkpoint and go back to their homes in the West Bank. And that is only going to happen after the first batch of Israeli captives are freed. The ceasefire basically held all day Friday. Israel allowed large quantities of aid and fuel and food and cooking oil for the first time into Gaza. But humanitarian officials say the need is so great that it's going to take a long time to be able to sort of catch up of how much need there is. Let me tell you one more thing. Israel dropped leaflets and told Palestinians not to try to go back to northern Gaza. Gaza is basically cut in half, and most of the population is now in the south. Israel has sort of taken over large swathes of the north, and Israel warned Palestinians not to try to go back to their homes in the north. And in some cases, there were reports that have not yet been confirmed that Israel used riot dispersal means to stop people from going back to the north of Gaza.
And one last thing, Linda, we've been talking about this first group of hostages and prisoners that are going to be released over the course of today, but the ceasefire lasts at least 4 days, perhaps longer. Do we know the mechanism yet for the additional Israeli hostages that are set to be released?
Yeah, we don't know. We don't know the mechanism yet, although it makes sense that it would basically be the same mechanism all of the time, that it would just be repeated. But we don't know in terms of timing. In fact, the first hostages were supposed to be released at 9 a.m. Eastern time. And, that didn't happen. It was delayed. So we don't know yet about the mechanism. But I think the assumption is it would be the same mechanism, and it would go, you know, from Gaza to Egypt and then from Egypt to Israel.
Linda Gradstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem. And we'll have more on this developing story at our website, voanews.com. Qatar has emerged as one of the main negotiators at the talks between Israel and Hamas. But how did this come to be? VOA Urdu's Faiza Bukhari gets the answer from Del Arbel, a scholar at the Center for Israeli Studies at American University, over Skype.
Qatar has emerged as one of the main negotiators in the talks between the Israel and Hamas. What makes it acceptable to Israel, which has been very skeptical of Qatar?
You know, Israel and Qatar, the relationship between them has been suffered ups and downs over the years. Israel and Qatar used to have diplomatic relations until the year 2000 when they broke off. But over the years, over the issue of Gaza, Israel recognized and allowed Qatar to have a special role in Gaza, including financial assistance to the people of Gaza. So Israel kind of, on one hand, allowed this and cooperated with Qatar, allowed it to have a special role in Gaza. On the other hand, it was somewhat suspicious of Qatari actions, of Qatar being basically the patron of Hamas. So there's a lot of criticism in Israel over Qatar's dual role. On one hand, you know, helping and saving and rescuing, releasing hostages. On the other hand, being Hamas's political and economic patron. So there's a lot of tension around that. But Israel understood that, you know, if you have the Qataris with such influence over Hamas, that may be helpful sometime down the road. And this time has come now with the issue of the hostages.
If all of the hostages are released, what do you see? Is there any possibility of an end to this war? Or is this going to continue?
We're saying that if, best case scenario, 80 are released out of 240, that's a third. That still leaves nearly 160 people still in the hands of Hamas. And Hamas is not going to let all of them go because for Hamas, they're a strategic asset. Holding on to them, basically gives Hamas leadership a lifeline. Because as long as they're negotiating over the release of these hostages, there's a good chance that they could survive somehow. So I don't see a permanent ceasefire being reached anytime soon. I believe that a ceasefire, in the way Israel views it, the way the U.S. views it, a ceasefire permanent would serve Hamas's interests, would allow it to regroup and reorganize it in an even better way. And also, it will continue to keep on to the hostages, holding the hostages. And who knows what will be the fate of the hostages if there's a ceasefire. So there's no interest on Israel's part at this point to go for a ceasefire. Further down the road, maybe an option. I don't see it in the coming weeks or months.
That's American University scholar at the Center for Israeli Studies, Dan Arbel, speaking with my colleague in the VOA Urdu service, Faiza Bukhari. Elsewhere, Ukraine's top truckers union said on Friday it hopes of a rapid end to Polish truckers' protests at the border were fading as Kyiv prepared to evacuate its haulers stranded in Poland. Anna Chernikova joins us from the Ukrainian capital with more. Anna, really quickly, for our listeners who may not be up to date on why and how this all began, can you kind of bring us back to the start of all this?
Yeah, basically, the protest of porous carriers began on November 6th, and it's now more than 2 weeks that almost all border crossings with Ukraine are blocked. The demand of Polish carriers is, among other things, is the introduction, and the main demand is introduction of commercial permits for Ukrainian companies to transport goods, with the exception of humanitarian aid and supplies from the Ukrainian for the Ukrainian army.
And one last thing before we let you go for the weekend. What have been the latest developments as the Ukrainian counteroffensive against the Russian full-scale invasion began, almost 2 years ago?
Well, as we've discussed in our previous programs, that basically this last week and last weeks, we can say the most difficult situation remain in the Donetsk region and in the Kherson region. Particularly in Donetsk region, we're talking about Avdiivka direction, and Russian forces are accumulating their forces in there, and Ukrainian forces are also strengthening their defense positions in there. What we hear, the latest what we hear from the Ukrainian authorities is that Ukrainians are getting ready for the third wave of Russian offensive in that area, in the Avdiivka direction. And it looks like, at least reportedly, according to Ukrainian officials, that this third wave has already began, and more active attacks and active actions from the Russian side is in place already.
Anna Chernikova reports for us from Kyiv, Ukraine. Anna, as always, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
And still to come, China wants to double its current nuclear energy output.
But safety concerns after the 2011 Fukushima incident are hindering China's nuclear growth.
This is VOA News. You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Miller. We now pick up part two of my conversation with Augusta University professors Craig Albert and Ahmed Alarood about their research into Arabic language anti-American propaganda that's found online.
One of the things that I thought was interesting that was mentioned in the paper, Craig Albert, was the notion that propaganda is part of a larger category of the umbrella of influence operations. So can you briefly explain to our listeners, you know, how that is a subset and what exactly influence operations are?
Okay, so it's all under the general umbrella of information warfare. Information warfare is just the idea that information actors are trying to change or influence the minds of decision makers is basically the best way to describe it simply. And then within that is influence operations. And that's like the type of tactics that are being used in the larger strategy of information warfare. And one of those tactics can be disinformation, for instance, can be misinformation, malinformation, and then propaganda. And propaganda exists, especially within the social media universe, as a way of affecting the emotions and the sentiments of the audience that receives that propaganda. So it's like if you look at it from a pyramid, it's like information warfare, then influence operations, and then within influence operations is propaganda.
Ahmed Alarood, I want to ask you about social media accounts, because as we've discussed, this research was using data from Twitter, now known as X. You know, in the past, you know, if we take a look at, say, the 2014 conflict between Israel and the Palestinians in Gaza, there were social media accounts who were chronicling the violence there. I'm thinking specifically of Farah Baker. You know, with doing your research, you know, how do you make the determination as to what is a human behind an account, a bot or an automated account, and who is a state actor and who is, you know, an individual, you know, recounting some information? I mean, I know you mentioned previously that you were using designators on Twitter or X that would specifically list someone as a state actor, but what happens if they aren't listed?
Yeah, so that's complicated because basically Twitter, currently X, they're using some AI and machine learning models to decide if those accounts are real humans or bots. And it's without going into technical details, it is related to some graph computations that happens on how often those accounts publish or tweet to who, what are their connections, if there is a certain pattern, for example, if they're tweeting every 10 minutes, 15 minutes, or if they're have non-regular tweets behavior. So that's one factor which is related to the behavior of those accounts. Second, it is related to the content that is shared by those accounts.
And finally, Craig Albert, the last question goes to you. Ostensibly, research is done to learn something, to get new information, to drive the conversation forward. So was anything uncovered that may shed some light on potential policy recommendations?
Yeah, the most important things that we can see are, first of all, definitely there is, you know, anti-American propaganda in the Middle East and Arabic-speaking countries. We hypothesize that it's going to be on the rise and on an increase. in the next, short-term and long-term, based on what we're seeing and definitely what's going on now with American support of Israel against the war against Hamas. And so some policies that we can do are, America is often, the United States often plays catch-up or is very reactive versus being proactive on influence operations or on counter-propaganda. And so the first thing the United States needs to do is to get a serious counter-propaganda policy in place that's a unified policy that's across the DOD, across the military. And we're not talking about necessarily one centralized command element. We just need to get on the same page. The U.S. needs to get all of its elements on the same page on how to combat anti-American propaganda on social media, and then how to take a proactive step at it as well. Because the United States is a democracy, it often doesn't like to instigate counter-propaganda operations domestically, even against external bad actors. And so we really recommend that the United States take a different look at this and say, well, how, even though it's a democracy, can it take a proactive stance, standing up for democratic rights, standing up for democratic policies, while sending out a positive message of the United States without really breaking people's privacy, their trust, their rights, or doing anything that more authoritarian. And so that's really what we're looking at, is how can the United States get kind of like a unity of policy command structure across the armed service branches, the different parts of the government, and create something that's more unified to combat anti-American propaganda operations.
Greg Albert is a professor, as well as the director of the Master of Arts in Intelligence and Security Studies at Augusta University. He's joined by Ahmed Al-Arood, an associate professor in the School of Computer and Cyber Sciences, also from Augusta University. Gentlemen, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Thank you.
And finally, China is pressing ahead with ambitious nuclear energy expansion plans. Can nuclear generation help the world's largest carbon emitter make the transition to clean energy? Shermaine Lee rounds us out.
China is pressing ahead with ambitious nuclear energy expansion plans. Can nuclear generation help the world's largest carbon emitter to make the transition to clean energy? Shermaine Lee reports from Berlin. Nuclear energy is expected to play a role in countries' discussions of energy transition at the planned COP28 climate conference in Dubai, as it is the world's second largest non-fossil source of electricity. It is a source that is growing the most quickly in China, which has now surpassed France as the world's second biggest nuclear energy generator, behind only the United States. China wants nuclear generation to account for 10% of its energy mix by 2035, twice the current level. But safety concerns after the 2011 Fukushima incident are hindering China's nuclear growth, according to Philip Andrews Speed, senior research fellow at the Oxford Institute of Energy Studies in the United Kingdom.
If there is a serious accident in or near China, or anywhere in the world, undermines the credibility of nuclear power. What happened after Fukushima was they suspended the construction of all new plants. They also said, and they've sustained this policy, no inland nuclear power plants.
These safety concerns have slowed nuclear growth in China. Even though China built its first nuclear plant in the mid-1980s, nuclear power makes up only about 5% of Chinese generation today. Even though nuclear is cleaner than coal-burning generation and more efficient than wind and solar, safety concerns, a shortage of skilled workers, and a shortage of available sites for new plants stand in the way.
Obviously, solar and wind depend on the weather. And you can get periods of no sun and no wind, as well as the fact that they go up and down each day. They're as much more reliable, you turn it on, it's there. The safety risks that we've talked about are just not there in solar. And yes, in wind, it can fall down or something, but maybe somebody's hurt, but it's not a major accident.
However, experts say the emergence of new technologies is making nuclear power safer than ever before. COP28 will begin in November 30th in Dubai. Shermaine Lee for VOA News, Berlin.
And that wraps things up for today. And until next week, I'm Steve Miller.
Stay up to date with VOA Podcasts. Each weekday, International Edition covers the world's biggest stories, while Flashpoint Iran and Flashpoint Ukraine examine their respective regions in depth every week.